Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. And I have to say, Life on Planet Porky has been quite busy these last two or three days, not just for myself. I'm, of course, Mike Porky Parry, but also for the lady in her executive studio on the other end of this line. And that is, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are we today?
Very good, Michael. Hotting up this week. It's a manically busy week with promotion for the Lennon book. Yes. So, trying to keep a lid on it.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it's Friday of this very week, October the 9th. What exactly is the anniversary on October the 9th, Miss Jones?
John Lennon would have turned 80 years old this coming Friday, which is unbelievable, really. I know we are used to Macca being 78 and sort of aging and Ringo kicking along and stuff. But, you know, it's a strange thing to think of John at 80.
Yes.
Because there is that phenomenon that when you die young, you remain that age forevermore.
Yeah.
So John is 40 in all of our minds, isn't he? And he always will be.
Yes. Well, James Dean is 23 in all our minds, isn't he?
If people are old enough to remember James Dean,
I remember pictures of him in New York on the New York subway and all that. The amazing thing about James Dean, which I sort of picked up somewhere along the way, was that only one of his films had been released by the time he died, and the other two were released after he died. You know, I can't even remember the name of them now. Was one of them called
East of Eden? Was one
East of Eden? That's right. Giant, was it, or something?
Giant, yeah. But we weren't even born, of course. So it's a funny thing. At one time, James Dean, Marilyn Monroe were the icons, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
Of the entire world. And I think my kids barely even know who they are.
No, it's absolutely true. When I go down to Bournemouth and stay with my sister, I stay in one of the suites they've got there, and it's the Marilyn Monroe suite. It's got pictures of Marilyn Monroe, you know, Art Nouveau.
Ooh. Has it got fur bed covers and that sort of sexy stuff going on in there?
No, it's just a sort of dedication to Marilyn Monroe. It's got like crystal mirrors with pictures of her in it and pictures of Marilyn Monroe on the wall and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's very tasteful.
Are you a big Marilyn Monroe fan?
No, not particularly, but, you know, my sister's just into glitz and glamour and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And she just thought it'd be nice to... I think what happened was she went into a mirror shop in Bournemouth somewhere, and there was this huge mirror, and it was, you know, done in little squares, a picture of Marilyn Monroe, you know, with beautiful red lips and all that kind of stuff, you know? So she thought it was so nice, she bought it and then brought it home and then put it in this room and then just sort of built... more Marilyn Monroe stuff around it, you know. So it's very nice anyway. So there we are.
It's a lovely idea. She should have all the books in there, you know, the biographies of Marilyn and show the films and that kind of thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, she's working towards that, you know. But it's very nice indeed. So there we are. Yeah, so John Lennon. And funny thing is, I will be working on television on Friday, so I'll be delighted to. It's bound to come up, you know. I mean, if you look in the TV schedules this week on BBC4 on Friday, the whole evening, because they don't start till 7 o'clock, BBC4, the whole evening is dedicated to John Lennon, including the full version of A Hard Day's Night, which, you know, is a it's a black and white film, but what a tribute that is to the Beatles. I don't think they weren't anywhere near their height then, but A Hard Day's Night is the original Beatles, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's not a brilliant film, but it's an iconic film because of
fantastic.
Who it represents and, you know, the time that it captured as well.
Yes.
It's a moment in time that we're not going back to, certainly.
Totally, I agree. And one of the nicest things about it, which I always reflect on when I see it, is that when the mop tops are in the goods wagon of the train, there's a bunch of schoolgirls there. One of them is the lady with the blonde hair who turned out to, who met George Harrison on the set of that film and then went and married him and Eric Clapton. And I've forgotten her name.
It's Patty Boyd.
Absolutely, yeah.
And her sister, Jenny, is a good friend of mine. And Jenny's got a bit of a history as well because Jenny married Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac twice.
It's incredible. Didn't she also have a fling with Mick Jagger? One of them.
I don't know about that. She's never talked about that, but maybe. Oh, Jenny, I always call her the younger, prettier of the Boyd sisters. Really? There was another who sadly died of drug overdose.
Oh, dear, that's terrible.
Way back when, yeah. But those two Boyd sisters, Patty and Jenny, were both in Rishikesh with the Beatles really? During the 60s when they went to find themselves in India with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Yeah, that's right. The man who they suddenly discovered, as John Lennon said, we're leaving, Maharishi. And he said, oh, why are you leaving? And he said, well, if you're so fucking cosmic, you should know.
Family show, come on. Yeah, the guru who turned out to be a fake, wasn't it?
They had a song about him called Sexy Sadie.
That's right, yeah, they had to tone it down.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Oh, dear. Well, anyway, enough of the Beatles, because we are Beatles fans, but, you know, we have to have a diet of Beatles, I suppose, in every show. Let's get on to things much more contemporary. And Tom Bauer is a very renowned author, like yourself, except he specialises in biographies of politicians and businessmen and that kind of stuff, where you specialise, Leslie Ann, in biographies of rock stars mostly. Mr. Bauer has written books on, you know, the rich and famous for many, many years, very successfully. And his latest one is on the current Prime Minister, Bojo or Boris Johnson. And I have to say, some amazing revelations have come out, have they not?
Explosive stuff, isn't it? I mean, it's billed as a sort of the most rounded portrait of the man, the mind, the politics, but yeah. It's gone into all sorts of family horrors. Mm. And I hadn't realised quite what a chip off the old block Boris is. Yes. And his father, Stanley, was a piece of work. And he apparently, allegedly, smacked Boris's mother in the face, broke her nose, and she wound up in hospital because of that. Well, and she has said in this book that she was made to feel that it was her fault, which is a classic line among abusers of wives, isn't it?
Well, listen, let's just put this into perspective. I'm not suddenly jumping into the defence for Stanley Johnson, Boris's father, but the way it's described is that there was a furious row and a flailing of arms. That's the way it's described, OK? And in that flailing of arms, Stanley Johnson's hand, you know, whipped out and came into contact with Boris Johnson's mother's face and broke her nose or damaged her nose. But he claims that he was equally, you know, sort of hit by a flailing hand on the other side. So he says there was absolutely no intent in it. And as you quite
well,
right,
he can say whatever he likes. Mm. You know, the fact is, a man should never hit a woman, even if she lashes out.
Oh, totally agree.
I think the idea is that you duck out of the way, you don't lash back. Yeah. You know, so I think this was an awful thing for their children to have witnessed.
Yeah.
And of course, it is true that men tend to grow up to treat women the way they saw their fathers treat their mothers.
Well, certainly.
Yeah, this was certainly the case in my marriage.
Really?
You know, I remember, yes, my late father-in-law said to me once, shortly after I married my husband, his son,
yes.
Well, of course, you know, marriage is only legalized prostitution.
Did he?
Yeah.
What a weirdo. How did you react when he said that?
Well, how does one react? I was young. I didn't have the gab, the lip that I have these days, but I think I probably tried to laugh it off. But it stayed in my mind. That's the point.
That is the classic description of the Kennedy family, by the way, because all the sons were complete sexual abusers of women, right? We spoke about Marilyn Monroe at the start of this very podcast, and of course she was the lover of at least two of the Kennedy boys, John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And their father, Joseph Kennedy, was a serial abuser all his life. You know, they had this huge compound up in Hyannisport in Massachusetts. But of course, he was always in Washington and New York, you know, in business and politics and all that kind of stuff. And he would actually bring his mistresses home to the Hyannisport compound and go and stay in a different part of their vast mansion whilst his wife would be told not to bother him for the weekend. And that's the way that the Kennedy sons conducted their relationships with their wives. And so I totally agree with you. It's something that passes down the generations.
What freaks me out is the way that we as women put up with this. Mm. You know, we feel, we come to feel that we don't deserve better and that we are worthless because that's the way we're treated. Mm. And it does tend to be the case, doesn't it, among these very high profile and successful politicians. Many of them do seem to be highly sexed and seem to feel that they have a right to not only a wife, but a mistress, and to shag anything else out there that's going.
Certainly. There was a politician that we employed once at Talk Sport Radio called Steve Norris, and he was known as Shagger Norris. He had seven mistresses in the House of Commons.
And they're generally quite unsavoury types. I mean,
well, he wasn't looking. I mean, seriously.
That's what I'm saying. They're not really people that you would throw yourselves at, are they?
No, he was a podgy middle-aged man with four chins, you know what I mean? And I don't know what it was. I mean, maybe power's an aphrodisiac for a woman or something, you know.
Or maybe the four chins are what do it. You know, maybe there's some kind of thing that you and I haven't thought of that one can do with four chins.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to be picking on people, but just imagine if you were... Yeah, if you imagine if you were John Prescott, the former Deputy Prime Minister under Tony Blair, you know, a big, fat, sort of loud-mouthed, not terribly bright... guy from Yorkshire who became Deputy Prime Minister because he was on the left side of the Labour Party and Tony Blair needed to keep that side of the party quiet, you see what I mean? And John Prescott, you know, represented the unions and all that. And all of a sudden he ends up with a mistress half his age, you know, running around after him and jumping into his bed and all that kind of stuff. So it must be power must be the aphrodisiac.
Yeah, like Henry Kissinger, wasn't it? I mean, he was another one. He, tiny little guy, not very easy on the eye, you'd have to say.
Yeah.
But he was another womanizer as well.
Is he really? Oh, it's disgraceful, isn't it? You know. But there we are. What can I say? Rao, what I was going to say about that Boris Johnson thing as well, I mean, you've told us about most of the revelations. What made me think that they're a completely dysfunctional family was a picture of Boris when he was about nine. And in those days, so that would have been 45 years ago, because I think he's about 55 now or something. So 45 years ago is going back to 1975. And Boris Johnson had shoulder length blonde hair as a kid. That didn't happen in 1975 unless you were sort of slightly odd.
There was a line that they were a feral bunch of children, that they weren't really being looked after properly.
Yes.
And all the kids had sort of long, flowing blonde hair and all looked very similar. And they still do. Joe and Rachel do look very like Boris, don't they?
Yeah, oh, they do. Yeah.
They were sort of detached from their families. And Boris was very confused and he couldn't form relationships with other boys because of it. And so he turned into this quite self-contained loner.
Yeah.
And he sought the company of women because he couldn't relate very well to men. I suppose you wouldn't be able to if you loathed your father.
No, that's absolutely right. Round about the same time in another publication, and obviously sticking the knife in, Petronella Wyatt, who you must be aware of, obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's not bad, actually. I quite like her.
Yeah, exactly. She writes a column in another paper, knowing that the Tom Bauer expose is coming out, you know, and tells the amazing story of how when she was Boris's mistress, he was out and about. I think he was a journalist in those days. I'm not quite sure if he was editor of The Spectator or what he was doing. But, you know, and that she's at her flat in London and she spends hours preparing this shrimp risotto. And apparently cooking...
Is that a euphemism?
No. I think she described it as a seafood risotto, okay?
Seafood and eat it, yeah.
Eat and eat it, that's right, yeah. And apparently... this involves, you know, a very, very delicate sort of balancing of the fish with the rice and all this kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And Boris is expected at 7 o'clock. He didn't turn up till 8:30. And so she'd had to sort of keep the risotto sort of warm, you know what I mean? And he walked in, looked at it and said, I can't eat this muck. give me a packet of crisps.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, that, well, that'll teach you. Mm. The one I felt sorry for throughout this was Marina, his wife of 25 years. And this great line about her as being his anchor, his consigliere, his ghost at the feast.
Yeah.
But, of course, she was the one who held it all together.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And and she put up with him being a complete shit, utterly selfish.
Family show, and, family show, you know.
Family show. But, you know, then he destroyed his whole family. And all those kids are walking around with a dysfunctional father who they can't get away from because he's the prime minister.
No, I totally agree. Funny enough, everybody's written Boris off because, you know, he had COVID-19. Has he come back to full strength? Can he survive this crisis in the government with, you know, the economic slump and all that. And yet Trevor Kavanagh, a man of extreme repute, writes this morning that everybody's got it wrong. Boris Johnson is ruthless. He's motivated. He's going to wipe the floor with his enemies. Just wait till he gets going again, you know. So I think we'll have to see. Anyway, moving on, I had a terrible experience on the way home from the studio yesterday. I like to say that because it makes me sound glamorous, you know.
You are glamorous, though.
Well, it's very kind of you. Thank you very much. But if you wear a mask, which you have to do on public transport, of course, right, then if you wear glasses, you're in a terrible pickle because the mask has to come over your nose on the tube. I'm on the London Tube, right, travelling across London. And, of course, the the breath out of your mouth goes up through the mask and into your glasses and it steams them up. So I'm trying to, you know, pick up on something in a paper I've got in my hand, quite a long tube journey from London Bridge down to sort of Surrey, you know. And halfway there, then I have to get a cab at the other end because, unfortunately, my rail route had been closed down because it was a Sunday. But anyway, that's another story. Point is, I was on the Underground for about half an hour and I couldn't keep reading with my glasses steamed up. So I put my glasses on the top of my head like a glamorous, you know, sort of film star would do, except they're not sunglasses, it's just my ordinary glasses, you know. By the time I get to my destination, I jump up, realizing, oh, this is my stop, and gather my paper and my bag, and I rush off the tube train. And all of a sudden, I can't read the messages on the wall. And I think, oh, hang on, where's my glasses? And I look back into the train, the doors had just shut, and the glasses had come off the back of my head and fallen on the floor, and the train disappeared into another tunnel. And that's the last I've seen of my £350 glasses. So rather a bad result.
Have you tried the lost property office?
I wouldn't even know where to start. I mean,
well, it's easy. You just find the number or the website and just get in touch with them because people hand things in on the tube all the time.
Yeah, they also step on things like glasses they can't see.
Yeah, you might get them back. I'd have a go at that if I were you.
I doubt it. They're very frail, if you see what I mean. They don't have frames and it's just two pieces of glass.
Yeah, I know your glasses.
And all that.
But I do that. I have different glasses for sitting at my desk, at my computer.
Yep.
I have others for reading. I have others just for going around the place.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've got three pairs of glasses on top of my head and still I can't find the bloody things.
Right, yeah. Well, you see, I didn't know where they were. I thought, oh, that's all right. I must have put them in my pocket. And I turned around and then I saw them on the tube train as boof, it disappeared, you know.
But I'm going to get you one of those chain things, you know, those strings that you wear them around your neck. That's probably for you.
But I only have one pair at a time. I mean, I've got several pairs of glasses, but they're all trifocals. And one pair in particular, which I'm glad I wasn't wearing yesterday, changes shade like John Lennon's glasses in the sun. You see what I mean? To protect my eyes.
But you can do those bifocal, trifocal things, can you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I can't. I tried them. I kept falling down the stairs.
That is a problem. I have to admit, that is a big problem. When you get a pair like that, you have to spend about 2 weeks literally training yourself to walk with them because you're absolutely right. You can't measure stepping off a pavement. You can't get upstairs. I totally agree. But anyway, look, that means it's a trip to Specsavers as soon as we finished here today, Ms. Jones, in order that I can feast my eyes on great literature and other things. Anyway, that's life. Now, Mariella Frostrup, is a modern-day radio journalist, actually, but she's had quite a varied career. She's done all sorts of things, including being a PR for record companies, and she tells the story of how one of the people she was promoting was Mark Almond. Is that soft sell?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, she's a great girl. I used to work with her a lot back in the day and knock around with her a little bit.
Yeah.
And she was a PR. She was quite plump in those days.
Oh, yeah.
She was one of those pretty plump girls. You know, she had a lovely round face and sort of quite dark hair. She's very different looking now.
Yeah.
And then, of course, her lovely husky voice took her onto the airwaves and she became a TV presenter and so on. But that whole thing of inventing lifestyles and stories for rock stars when they don't perhaps want the complete truth to be out there, which was common back in the day, that was a big thing.
Yeah.
I remember Tony Brainsby used to do it when he first took on the PR for Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you had a band full of eggheads. You had Brian May, the astrophysicist. You had John Deacon, the engineer. You had Roger Taylor, who was training to be a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have all had whacking great careers in other fields. But there was Freddie Mercury, who had no educational qualifications and he had absolutely nothing at all. But they invented this whole history for him that wasn't actually the truth.
Really?
And of course, it all comes out in the end that he got kicked out of school.
I thought Freddie did have a long-term girlfriend, marry somebody.
No, I'm talking about academic qualifications.
Oh, but why would they want... Oh, I see, just to sort of put him in parallel with the rest of the group, you mean?
Yeah, because it made him look bad and he was the front man, so they had to bring him up to their level. So so rewriting history in the past was a big function of the PR back in the day. Mariella's right.
Golly.
And they all did do that kind of thing. I think everyone saw through it because along came the internet and suddenly everyone can find out everything about everybody.
Yeah. Right.
So it became an obsolete pursuit.
Yes, that's right, but pointless. By the way, sorry, I don't know why I'm going back to this, but we mentioned Tom Bauer, who was the biographer of Bojo, Boris Johnson. And I meant to tell you, because your club in Soho is the, what's it called again?
The Groucho Club.
Yeah, and Tom Bauer wrote something once about the publisher Richard Desmond. Richard Desmond at the time owned the Express and Star newspapers, but he'd started his publishing career with porn magazines. Was it Northern and Shell, I think, or something his company was called. And they published sort of soft porn mags, including one called Asian Babes and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, God, it was gross, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I remember Tom wrote something on him. Mr. Desmond sued him. There was a great High Court case. In the end, the judge threw out the complaint from Richard Desmond that Tom Bauer had libeled him or whatever, and the whole of the media sort of world, media village, whatever you want to call it, was so delighted because they all had a grudge against Mr. Desmond because Mr. Desmond was successful and quite a disciplinarian to his staff and all that kind of stuff. And they had a 3-day party in the Groucho to celebrate. And Tom Bauer ever since has been a sort of a hero of the, the media world. But I only told you that because I forgot to tell you when we were talking about Tom Bauer and Bojo. And
well, you know, Richard Desmond, he was another one who dumped his wife for a bit of stuff, you know. And I used to look, because I did work for the Sunday Express. I had a column for some time, about 10 years ago.
Right.
And I used to look at her. She was quite a pleasant looking younger woman that he ran off with. And I thought, what the hell do you see in him? And why would you want to live with a pornographer?
Yeah.
It's kind of the lowest of the low, isn't it?
Well, you see, you're being very judgmental there. Millions, you know, when you said, oh, he dropped his wife for a new bit of stuff, millions and millions of men go into second marriages for whatever reason, you know what I mean? So
yeah, it's usually a big midlife crisis, isn't it?
I don't know, because I never had a first marriage, so I never got into the second one, if you heard him.
I always remember Rod Gilchrist, who was an editor of mine at the Daily Mail years ago.
I knew Rod very well, yeah.
Roddy Gilchrist. And he said to me that this was about the time my marriage broke up, and he took me out for lunch to console me. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, in my circle of friends, men get to midlife and about half of us go off and find someone new because we're trying to reinvent ourselves and to claw back our virile youth.
Yeah.
And he said about the other half stay with their wives and see it through thick and thin. And we come out the other side and we're really, really glad that we stayed with the wife. And the ones who ran off with somebody new and fresh and young tend to regret it and wish they'd stayed with what they had.
Mm.
So maybe there's a message for Boris here.
Do you know, a lot of that makes so much sense because I can think of three colleagues through my Fleet Street years and my subsequent career in broadcasting who had a second relationship. It didn't always end up in marriage, right? But the three of them, 20 years later, all went back to their first wife. I mean, it's amazing, honestly. I had a great mate called Gordon Ducker. Gordon was a great guy. He was
not his real name.
What's his name? Gordon Ducker, yeah.
What a shame.
What are you laughing for?
Well, I'm not sure I'd want to sign a check. Gordon Ducker, you know, that is going to be a source of amusement for the whole of your life, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I never thought it was that funny. But
it's just my dirty mind. Family show.
I think it is, yeah. He was a very principled guy. He was a reservist in the RAF, okay? And he reached the rank of squadron leader. So we used to call him Winko, as in Wing Commander, you know, Winko. And he'd sometimes appear in his RAF uniform. He's a very principled man. And for instance, when the first Gulf War broke out, he was drafted in and had to go out to the Middle East and control media matters, you know what I mean? Releases from the military and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, he was a terribly decent bloke, and he had a midlife crisis and fell for a lady who worked on the Daily Express who was half his age. And that led to the breakup of his marriage and all that. But anyway, years later, after we weren't working together anymore, but we sort of kept in touch, he rang me up and told me that he and his first wife had got back together again, you know, after a split of about 12 or 13 years. And I was so pleased for him, but I'm afraid the story's got a very sorry ending. Months later, his son rang me to tell me that his dad had got stomach cancer and it was inoperable, and he died 6 weeks later.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I wonder whether something in his body told him the end is near and he wanted to go back to his...
It's possible, but, you know, I cannot understand these wives. Why, when your husband has betrayed you to such a monstrous extent, why would you have him back?
Yeah.
Because I bloody wouldn't.
No, well, you know, I think it's each their own, really. I mean, I don't know how you answer that one.
I suppose that what it becomes is not so much a midlife crisis as a midwife crisis.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that fantastic pun.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself and Miss Jones. Miss Jones, of course, who's laying the law down here on, you know, don't be a doormat wife. And, you know, she's telling it as it is. Tell me something else, Miss Jones. Have you got a favourite experience from your childhood or even from your adolescence or even throughout your career as the rock chick writer extraordinaire about going to the cinema?
Well, you know, I think about this. I don't remember going to the cinema as a child.
Really?
And I know lots of people did.
I remember my mum taking me to see the little elephant with the big ears, Dumbo.
Yeah. Was she trying to tell you something?
Nice.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. So you think I'm a bit of a Dumbo, do you? Huh?
No, sorry. I'm really sorry. It just slipped out. Right. I don't remember going to the cinema as a child. No, it wasn't part of our family culture, I suppose. It was a funny family we had because we were two tiers. Mm-hmm. My mum had my brother and me very close together,
right.
18 months. And then there was a gap of about 8 years. And then two sisters came along very close together as well. So right. I think by the time my brother and I would have been old enough to do that kind of thing, go to the cinema and so on, my mum was then taken up with two new little ones.
Right.
So we tended to do things that we could go off and do without our parents being involved. Yeah. My dad was always working.
Yeah.
Dad was always away somewhere, you know, going to match reporting or on tour with someone. And so we did things like the guides and the scouts and all that. Mm. So not cinema. If you ask me for my most memorable cinema experience, I was invited to the premiere of the original Star Wars.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I was, you know, a guest, a VIP guest at this thing because I was writing for newspapers in those days, and I fell asleep, and apparently I snored, and I was in the front two rows, and that's sci-fi is not my thing, obviously.
No, sci-fi is not my thing really either. I don't think I've ever seen a Star Wars film all the way through, you know, Obi-Con Wobie or whatever his name is.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, even I know that.
Yeah, and Darth Vader and all that. But the reason I ask is because there's a chain of cinemas in this country run by a company called Cineworld, and they are, you know, making it absolutely clear that if the economic recession doesn't get better soon, i.e. asking the government to lift the lockdowns and lift the curfews and all that kind of stuff, half the cinemas they own will probably never reopen. And although I, you know, remember the cinema as a kid, and I do, my mum used to take me and my two sisters are only a year apart each, you see. So the three of us were born in three consecutive years. So we were really, you know, just a group, a family together, and mum could take us all to the cinema. And I remember we saw dreadful films like Seven Brides of Seven Brothers, you know, which is obviously something that would have appealed to my mum in those days, but we were bored stiff, you know, because we didn't understand all these cowboys dancing around with all these women in, you know, sort of flowery dresses and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, the point is, I always liked the cinema in those days because you could go off on your own and see all these children's films on a Saturday morning. But more recently, much more recently, I now go to a cinema in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, where you get a reclining armchair with a table next to it on which you can put your wine and a bag of licorice all sorts on the other side. And I am in heaven. You know, absolute heaven, because I love, you know, the big screen and a great film. For instance, the new James Bond film, which has now been postponed, by the way, until April next year, April 2021. And that could be the death of the cinema industry.
I think that was coming anyway, because of things like Netflix. I think that people are more inclined to go for home entertainment these days. Yeah. People are investing in bigger and bigger screens to watch content on in their own houses. Yeah. And I've not been out to the cinema really for a long time. We've got a nice picture house where I live in Dulwich.
Yeah.
And one of those nice little local cinemas, you know, quite cool, trendy place, yes, like you've just described. But I'm not inclined to go there by myself.
Yeah.
And most of my friends are couples.
Yes, sure.
So it's not as if I, sure, you know, I think it's different for a man. I still think it is to go to anything by yourself.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's different for a guy. But I do think that watching films is coming more in-house, and that cinemas were in decline anyway.
Yeah, bound to. I totally agree. Netflix and all that kind of stuff will just buy up all the big films. No, you're right. The cinema I used to go to, I only went twice a year, but it was a great film, a great new film. I'd go and have three drinks in the bar before the film, and it was a proper, you know, cocktail bar, and then literally take my drinks in and get served inside. It's fantastic. But anyway, there we are. My one unfortunate experience in a cinema was taking a young lady to see Night Fever, okay, the debut film of one John Travolta. And she was mesmerised by the shot of John Travolta waking up in his bedroom in a pair of black underpants. And, I mean, it changed her life and made me feel unworthy and pathetic.
He had six pairs of socks stuffed down there. Don't you worry.
Oh, well, now I'm...
Family show. I know, family show.
We don't get into that sort of thing. But, no.
It was Saturday Night Fever, by the way, the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, the song was Night Fever, wasn't it? Yeah. Thank you very much for reminding me. I could never understand the opening lines of that Bee Gees song. Now, you can tell by the way I use my walk. I'm a woman's man. No need to talk. Does that make any sense to you?
If that's the exact lyric, yeah, without looking it up. Yeah, I mean, you know about lyrics. Lyrics have to rhyme.
Yeah.
That's the primary function of them, because they have to be memorable so that people will sing them and that the song will sort of become hooky and in people's heads. So, I mean, they're not always grammatically correct even, are they? I always think of songs like Mid-Year, If I Was, and I'm there screaming at the radio going, if I were, you know, it's completely wrong. But there are a few McCartney songs where he's got the lyrics a little bit twisted and you think, oh dear, but they don't set out to be grammatically correct.
I totally agree, and you're right about that. How do I feel, tell me, Ms. Jones, how do I feel about learning that Dolly Parton is going to pose naked for Playboy again at the age of 75?
Oh, not really. No, thank you. Keep that in your pants. I'm sure she won't be doing the full frontal leg spread number, will she?
Well, I mean, come on.
I don't want to see that. I really don't want to see that. I'm coming out in hives at the thought. Yeah,
yes, exactly. I mean, to start off with, how much of what we see of Dolly Parton was there when she was born and how much of it has been
What, you think she's had that kind of surgery?
Well, look, I mean, she looks remarkable for 75 anyway, just a facial picture.
Yeah, she does, but do you want to see her bits down below? Because I really don't.
No.
This is taking us back into Richard Desmond's shagger granny territory, isn't it?
Oh, listen, Miss Jones, for goodness sake, you know, there are certain standards you have to, concur to when we're doing Life on Planet Porky. No, listen, I think it's absolutely true that Dolly Parton, who has a fantastic historical background of coming out of a family of 13 children and living in a sort of corrugated shack in Tennessee or somewhere like that to become one of the world's most successful pop stars, was a very voluptuous and beautiful girl when she arrived in what's the home of country music?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee, you're absolutely right, yeah. And how on earth she managed to navigate her way around, you know, sort of groping record producers and all that all these years, I don't know. But I think bits have been added on since. My favourite quote from her was...
I know what you're going to say, about the feet, right?
Sorry, about what, sorry?
About the feet.
No, well, I'll tell you one that I know, and then you tell me yours. She was asked once by a fan, you know, how long does it take to do your hair up before a show? And she says, don't ask me, I'm not usually there.
That's brilliant. Yeah, but... No, the one where she says about the reason why she has such tiny feet, because nothing grows in the shade.
Nothing grows. Oh, dear me.
You had to think about that, didn't you?
Yeah, yes, I did. Yeah, I think we'll move on because, you know, this is a family show.
Significant bazoom.
Significant bazoom, absolutely right. I bet that over the course of your career, you've interviewed Don McLean, American Pie.
I have. I absolutely adore Don McLean, even though he's gone off with a young kind of playboy type model.
Yeah.
I do adore him. American Pie is one of the all-time favourites, isn't it? My father was a big fan. I think he brought back that first album when he was touring America. Right. And that was my first exposure to Don McLean.
Yeah.
And it's one of those songs you say to people, oh, yeah, know all the words. No, you don't. And then, of course, it comes on and you sing all the words. It was my birthday recently and the kids gave me a wonderful barbecue in the back garden, and as it got dark and we lit all the candles out there and the guitars came out,
yes,
my son and my daughter's boyfriend, we were all singing and we did American Pie and everyone knew the words.
Golly, that's amazing, isn't it? The reason I brought him up is he's 75 today, and as you quite rightly say, he had not a midlife crisis, a late life crisis. His girlfriend's about 22, isn't she, or
Yeah, I mean, young enough to be his granddaughter. It's horrifying, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose it is a bit. I think I've told you this before, haven't I, that I went to interview Don McLean, but at the time I was working, for the Birmingham Mail in London. You know, we had a London office and that's where I worked. And so you were a jack of all trades. Half the time I was in Parliament doing politics. I was in the High Court and then I was doing news stories. And then whenever showbiz interviews came in, I went along and did them and did Don McLean. But of course, because I worked for a provincial newspaper, I was right at the end of the queue. So I'm sure you've been in this situation yourself many times. I had to wait all day until everybody else had talked to him. I went in, started talking to him, and he fell asleep. And I only got about 3 minutes of his time. And then somebody said, I'm sorry, Don's talked out now, you'll have to go. And that was it. So I had to make the rest up.
Well, you didn't wake him up.
I couldn't wake him up because, you know, there was an assistant there who said, oh, he's had it. I'm sorry, he's finished. That's it. You'll have to go. So,
well, he literally fell asleep in front of you in the interview.
Because I was talking to him, you know. So
that's outrageous.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so clearly...
Well, I suppose you could have written that. I mean, that's the story, isn't it, really? You write what's in front of you.
I suppose I would have done these days, obviously. But, you know, I was a young reporter in those days thinking, I don't know what to do here now. And so I just had to go and talk to other people who'd spoken to him and just nick a bit of their stuff, you know, and sort of put it all together.
Make it up.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
No way would you make up a story.
I didn't make it up. I found out what he'd said to other people and then stole, you know, I made out that I was just being chummy afterwards, went into the pub and saw some of them. And I said, oh, fantastic, isn't it? What did he say to you? I said, oh, yeah. He said, oh, yeah. Well, what about this? What about that? So I just picked it all up from then. That's because that I have rat-like cunning, you know. When things don't work, you have to...
Rat up a drainpipe, Michael.
Yes, well, that's absolutely right. Let me mention one more pop star that you may have come across during your career, Sting.
Oh, God. Sting. Oh, dear. So I had some bad experiences with Sting and Trudy.
Why?
So I went round to their house, right, North London. Yeah. They live in the house, or one of their many million-pound houses. Yeah. This one in North London, Highgate, used to belong to Yehudi Menuhin,
right,
the violinist.
Yeah.
And it was very quaint. It had all these sort of wood-paneled walls and stuff. And his wife, Trudy, was sort of poncing around in her exercise gear and stuff. And I'd actually gone to interview them both for a magazine piece.
Right.
And I'd written this up. And this was a few years ago, you know. Yeah. And then cut to, I was sent back a few years later to interview her.
Right.
For some newspaper.
Right.
And when I got there, the front door was opened by one of those, you know, the Kayapo indigenous Brazilian tribes people that have the saucer in the bottom of their mouth.
Like a plate.
You know, the ones that have like a disc coming out of their bottom lip?
Like a plate in their bottom lip, yeah.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. They're called the Kayapo Indians, and they wear just a loincloth, that's it, nothing else, barefoot. So this guy opens the door to me and asks me if I'd like a cup of tea, and they put me in a side room.
With this plate in his mouth, is he able to speak?
Yeah, yeah, well, kind of. I mean, I didn't really get what he was saying, but anyway, I had a cup of tea.
You go to this house, the door's open, a bloke with a plate in his mouth comes to the door, offers to make you a cup of tea, yeah.
Yeah, and then he brings the tea, and then they keep me waiting for over an hour. I'm just sitting there looking at myself, and eventually Trudy swans into the room, brandishing the copy of this magazine from several years earlier,
really,
where I'd written about her, and apparently I had dared to misquote her,
right,
and she'd borne a grudge all these years. Instead of complaining to the magazine at the time and saying, you know, she misquoted me, I didn't say this, blah, 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 there was never any complaint, because guess what? I hadn't misquoted her. She just hadn't liked the way it had turned out. So she brandished this thing. She proceeded to humiliate me beyond words in front of this poor Kayapo tribesman with the plate in his mouth. And then she unceremoniously flung me out of the house without allowing me the interview. So she had just dragged me up to her house to have a go at me in front of this guy, presumably to show what a powerful, important, and, woman to be reckoned with she was, only to then fling me out onto the street without giving me the interview. What was the point?
What a shocking story, and what a shockingly pompous woman. She's only the wife of a rock star. She's not a rock star in her own right. And to keep you waiting an hour is disgusting. Treat any human being with such little respect means that you and yourself are a piece of filth. You know what I mean? But did you know, you just said to me, did you write the story about Don McLean falling to sleep? Did you get a story out of her ejecting you from the house?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I went full tantric. You know, I think that's when it all went off the side, when Sting started spewing all about their tantric sex life. You just thought, what a tosser.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And he must have brought that chap back from the Amazon, because I remember, you know, there was a documentary and newspaper pictures of Sting paddling up the Amazon with the, you know, the man with the plate in his mouth in the canoe with him. So he'd obviously sort of gone a bit mad about about the forest or something, the Amazon.
Oh, they call him the self-appointed troubadour of the forest, don't they? Yeah. And he does all this world music now, which he's full of it. I don't get it.
Well,
not for me, thank you.
Yeah, good luck to him. And reason we got onto that story is because he is now 69.
I know. Oh, and not only that, Lindsay Buckingham, 71. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Now, there's another guy. He's a complete arse, actually. Sorry, family show. But he's very up himself.
Whoa.
He was the one who put it around that Stevie Nicks used to pay a roadie to blow cocaine up her bottom.
Oh, no. I mean, really, we're getting... This is becoming disgraceful, Miss Jones. I'm saying, look, if you have these stories, then that's fine. But, I mean, you know, write a book about, you know, these exceptional stories which aren't fit for a family podcast. I mean...
You love it. You know you do.
I'm not even going to think about what you've just told me. It's great. So what I was going to say about Lindsay Buckingham is that he must have been a massive influence on Fleetwood Mac with all the great musicians in there, because if I've got it right, Rumours was one of the world's most successful ever LPs. Rumours, Fleetwood Mac, that fantastic portrait on the front of Mick Fleetwood and Stevie Nicks. But then apparently he got artistic control of the follow-up, and it was a double album which completely flopped, and it was called Musk or something, wasn't it? What was it called?
It was called Tusk.
Tusk, that's it, yeah.
I quite like Musk.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the thing about Lindsay, he was so full of self-importance. He hadn't been able to give it away as a solo artist prior to Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
Then he got together with Stevie and they called themselves Buckingham Nicks.
Right.
That didn't really go anywhere. Mm. And then it was their collision with the dregs of the old Fleetwood Mac in Los Angeles that led to this sort of Anglo-American supergroup that then, because of all their inter-band marriages and relationships all breaking up at the same time, led to this extraordinary explanation of human error, I suppose you'd have to call it, which was Rumours. And every single song on that album was something that we can all relate to.
Right.
And that's why it was such a huge success.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like a personal pain in every song, you mean?
Yeah.
It was extraordinary.
You'd listen to it wincing, thinking, oh, God, yeah, I know exactly what they mean.
Yeah. I'm awfully sorry. I know this is a family podcast, but I can't get out of my head what you just said about Lindsay Bucks and Lindsay Bucks. Why on earth would Stevie Nicks employ somebody to insert cocaine into her anus?
Family show, well, come on. I think it's to do with, and I've only ever had wet vices myself. I've never taken drugs. So, no, we won't get there. But I think it's to do with the fact of when your septum in your nose breaks down and you can no longer snort the drug nasally, that you have to find alternative orifices, let's say, via which to ingest it.
I was going to say, alternate ways to ingest it into your system, you mean?
And, of course, the French are no strangers to taking things up the rear, are they?
Oh, my God.
I'm talking medication.
What have you had for breakfast today? You had sherry on your cornflakes this morning.
I'm talking medication. So, you know, we're a bit averse to putting things up. Sorry, it's a complete meltdown. Putting things up our bums.
What do you mean, averse? It just never happens in this household that I live in. So, you know.
So you never use suppositories or anything?
I'm not even going to. I'm going to change the subject and ask you what you think about the latest amazing things happening in the mad world of Donald Trump. Going into hospital 1 minute with COVID, and then in the middle of the night getting up, getting into a car, coming out, waving to his fans on the street. I mean, talk about Nutsville. You couldn't make it up.
No, you couldn't. I mean, he's what, 73?
74,
He's a pretty old guy. He's in the high-risk category. When I watched that press conference he gave from the hospital, I was a bit horrified because he did really look pretty unwell, didn't he?
Well, I've looked at it again and again, and I can't tell the difference sometimes between a well and an unwell Donald Trump, because he's always so full of himself and his face is always glowing and his energy and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not sure.
Don't you think he's a bit old to be a president? And don't you think Biden is as well? I had a look at, you know, George Washington was only 57 when he became the first president of the United States. Yeah. JFK was only 43 when he was sworn in.
Yeah.
Is it not a case that these two septuagenarians are just too old to be taken seriously? And can they really run what they call the greatest country in the world?
Well, the conundrum about America, and you know it at least as well and probably better than I do, is that it's full of dynamic, you know, successful, enterprising people. And yet they always seem to end up with people in power, you know, in the presidency and all the top officers of state, who aren't really, you know, up to it, really, when there's so many talented people there. I think people in America just realise that you can have a better life just by making yourself a fortune without having to get into politics, and therefore those who can't do it go into politics.
Yeah, it's all about personal life, though, isn't it, over there? And if you've got anything to hide, the last thing you want to do is put your head above the parapet.
That's absolutely true. You're absolutely right. You know, a bit of a private life and all that kind of stuff. But it's quite extraordinary. We don't know what's going to happen now with the election. We don't know whether there's going to be, well, there will be an election. There has to be, because it's constitutionally, the 25th Amendment says it's got to go ahead in one form or another. But Trump might be dead by then. I don't wish that upon him, but, you know,
of course not. But does Pence get sworn in at that stage? What happens?
Well, it depends which political commentator you speak to. The thing is that about 2 million people in America have already voted in the postal vote, you know, which has been allowed because of the numbers of people who gather at polling stations. And Trump's name is already on the ballot. It could be that people have voted for a dead man by the time they get to the election day. I'm not wishing him dead at all, but as you quite rightly point out, at 74, 6 foot 3 inches tall, clinically obese, he's in a vulnerable category, you know? So nobody knows. Mike Pence would immediately take over upon the death of the president, just as Lyndon Baines Johnson did when President Kennedy was shot. But after that, nobody knows. I'm afraid it's unknown territory, literally.
So do all those postal votes then get discounted?
No, because the process of the vote has started, so they can't stop it and start again. They will then be transferred to the person who the Republican Party then nominate as their leader. It's a very, you know, awkward situation because it's never happened before, so we don't really know. Anyway, at that point, Miss Jones, we have to now repair back to our domestic lives. Hopefully you won't be obsessed for the rest of the day with some of the subjects which you've been through on this. And, you know, I hope that you will return to the domestic bliss of your family.
I'm very busy this week. I'm going to be on Steve Wright in the afternoon on BBC Radio 2 on Wednesday afternoon.
Brilliant.
And I shall be on Sky News on Friday afternoon for John's birthday. Oh, so, yeah, various press interviews and stuff going on. So busy, busy week, cracking on.
Good. Well, that's glad. I like to see you busy. All right, Miss Jones, take care of yourself. And we will, funnily enough, be broadcasting after this one on Friday, October the 9th, John's 80th birthday.
Looking forward to that. See you on the other side.
Indeed. There was a politician that we employed once at Talk Sport Radio called Steve Norris, and he was known as Shagger Norris. He had seven mistresses in the House of Commons.
And they're generally quite unsavoury types. I mean,
well, he wasn't even looking. I mean, seriously.
That's what I'm saying. They're not really people that you would throw yourselves at, are they?
No, he was a podgy middle-aged man with four chins, you know what I mean? And I don't know what it was. I mean, maybe power's an aphrodisiac for a woman or something, you know.
Or maybe the four chins are what do it.
Why on earth would Stevie Nicks employ somebody to insert cocaine into her anus?
Family show, well, come on. I think it's to do with, and I've only ever had wet vices myself. I've never taken drugs. So, no, we won't get that. But I think it's to do with the fact of when your septum in your nose breaks down and you can no longer snort the drug nasally, that you have to find alternative orifices, let's say, to ingest it.
I was going to say, alternate ways to ingest it into your system, you mean?
And, of course, the French are no strangers to taking things up the rear, are they?
Oh, my God.
I'm talking medication.
What have you had for breakfast today? You had sherry on your cornflakes this morning. Northern and Shell, I think, or something his company was called, and they published sort of soft porn mags, including one called Asian Babes and all that kind of stuff.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.